Black Boy, Disc 7.
On the last night of the revival, the preacher asked all those who were members of the church to stand. A good majority of those present rose. Next, the preacher called upon the Christians who were not members of any church to stand. More responded. There remained now but a few young men who, belonging to no church, and professing no religion, were scattered sheepishly about the pews. Having thus isolated the sinners, the preacher told the deacons to prevail upon those who lived in darkness to discuss the state of their souls with him. The deacons sped to their tasks and asked us to go into a room and talk with a man chosen and anointed of God. They held our arms and smiled as they bent and talked to us. Surrounded by people I knew and liked, with my mother's eyes looking pleadingly into mine, it was hard to refuse. I followed the others into a room where the preacher stood. He smiled and shook our hands. "Now, you young men," he began in a brisk, clipped tone, "I want all of you to know God. I'm not asking you to join the church. But it's my duty as a man of God to tell you that you are in danger. Your peril is great. You stand in the need of prayer. Now, I'm going to ask each of you a personal favor. I want you to let the members of this church send up a prayer to God for you. Now, is there any soul here so cold, so hard, so lost that he would say no to that? Can you refuse to let the good people of this community pray for you?" He paused dramatically, and no one answered. All the techniques of his appeal were familiar to me, and I sat there feeling foolish, wanting to leap through the window and go home and forget about it. But I sat still, filled more with disgust than sin. "Would any man in this room dare fling no into God's face?" the preacher asked. There was silence. "Now I'm going to ask all of you to rise and go into the church and take a seat on the front bench," he said, edging on to more definite commitments. "Just stand up," he said, lifting his hands, palms up, as though he had the power to make us rise by magic. "That's it, young man," he encouraged the first boy who rose. I followed them, and we sat like wet ducks on a bench facing the congregation. Some part of me was cursing. A low, soft hymn began. "This may be the last time, I don't know." They sang it, hummed it, crooned it, moaned it, implying in sweet, frightening tones that if we didn't join the church then and there, we might die in our sleep that very night and go straight to hell. The church members felt the challenge, and the volume of song swelled. Could they sing so terrifyingly sweet as to make us join, burst into tears, and drop to our knees? A few boys rose and gave their hands to the preacher. A few women shouted and danced with joy. Another hymn began. "It ain't my brother, but it's me, O Lord, standing in the need of prayer." During the singing, the preacher tried yet another ruse. He intoned mournfully, letting his voice melt into the singing, yet casting his words above it. "How many mothers of these young men are here tonight?" Among others, my mother rose and stood proudly. "Now, good sweet mothers, come right down in front here," said the preacher. Hoping that this was the night of my long-deferred salvation, my mother came forward, limping, weeping, smiling. The mothers ringed their sons around, whispering, pleading. "Now, you good, sweet mothers, symbols of Mother Mary at the tomb, kneel and pray for your sons, your only sons," the preacher chanted. The mothers knelt. My mother grabbed my hands, and I felt hot tears scalding my fingers. I tried to stifle my disgust. We young men had been trapped by the community, the tribe in which we lived and of which we were a part. The tribe, for its own safety, was asking us to be at one with it. Our mothers were kneeling in public and praying for us to give the sign of allegiance. The hymn ended, and the preacher launched into a highly emotional and symbolic sermon, recounting how our mothers had given birth to us, how they had nursed us from infancy, how they had tended us when we were sick, how they had seen us grow up, how they had watched over us, how they had always known what was best for us. He then called for yet another hymn, which was hummed. He chanted above it in a melancholy tone, "Now I'm asking the first mother who really loves her son to bring him to me for baptism." God damn, I thought. It had happened quicker than I had expected. My mother was looking steadily at me. "Come, son, let your old mother take you to God," she begged. "I brought you into the world. Now let me help to save you." She caught my hand and I held back. "I've been as good a mother as I could," she whispered through her tears. "God is hearing every word," the preacher underscored her plea. This business of saving souls had no ethics. Every human relationship was shamelessly exploited. In essence, the tribe was asking us whether we shared its feelings. If we refused to join the church, it was equivalent to saying no, to placing ourselves in the position of moral monsters. One mother led her beaten and frightened son to the preacher amid shouts of amen and hallelujah. "Don't you love your old crippled mother, Richard?" my mother asked. "Don't leave me standing here with my empty hands," she said, afraid that I would humiliate her in public. It was no longer a question of my believing in God. It was no longer a matter of whether I would steal or lie or murder. It was a simple, urgent matter of public pride, a matter of how much I had in common with other people. If I refused, it meant that I didn't love my mother. And no man in that tight little black community had ever been crazy enough to let himself be placed in such a position. My mother pulled my arm, and I walked with her to the preacher and shook his hand, a gesture that made me a candidate for baptism. There were more songs and prayers. It lasted until well after midnight. I walked home limp as a rag. I hadn't felt anything except sullen anger and a crushing sense of shame. Yet I was somehow glad that I had got it over with. No barriers now stood between me and the community. "Mama, I don't feel a thing," I told her truthfully. "Don't you worry. You'll grow into feeling it," she assured me. And when I confessed to the other boys that I felt nothing, they too admitted that they felt nothing. "But the main thing is to be a member of the church," they said. The Sunday of the baptism arrived. I dressed in my best and showed up sweating. The candidates were huddled together to listen to a sermon in which the road of salvation was mapped out from the cradle to the grave. We were then called to the front of the church and lined up. The preacher, draped in white robes, dipped a small branch of a tree in a huge bowl of water and hovered above the head of the first candidate. "I baptize thee in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost," he pronounced sonorously as he shook the wet branch. Drops trickled down the boy's face. From one boy to another he went, dipping the branch each time. Finally my turn came, and I felt foolish, tense. I wanted to yell for him to stop. I wanted to tell him that all this was so much nonsense. But I said nothing. The dripping branch was shaken above my head, and drops of water wet my face and scalp, some of it rolling down my neck and wetting my back, like insects crawling. I wanted to squirm, but I held still. Then it was over. I relaxed. The preacher was now shaking the branch over another boy's head. I sighed. I had been baptized. Even after receiving the right hand of fellowship, Sunday school bored me. The Bible story seemed slow and meaningless when compared to the bloody thunder of pulp narrative, and I wasn't alone in feeling this. Other boys went to sleep in Sunday school. Finally, the boldest of us confessed that the entire thing was a fraud, and we played hooky from church. As summer neared, my mother suffered yet another stroke of paralysis, and again I had to watch her suffer, listen to her groans, powerless to help. I used to lie awake nights and think back to the early days in Arkansas, tracing my mother's life, reliving events, wondering why she had apparently been singled out for so much suffering, meaningless suffering, and I would feel more awe than I had ever felt in church. My mind could find no answer, and I would feel rebellious against all life, but I never felt humble. Another change took place at home. We needed money badly, and Granny and Aunt Addie decided that we could no longer share the entire house, and Uncle Tom and his family were invited to live upstairs at a nominal rental. The dining room and the living room were converted into bedrooms, and for the first time, we were squeezed for living space. We began to get on each other's nerves. Uncle Tom had taught school in country towns for 30 years, and as soon as he was under the roof, he proceeded to tell me what was wrong with my life. I ignored him, and he resented it. Rattling pots and pans in the kitchen would now awaken me in the mornings, and I would know that Uncle Tom and his family were getting breakfast. One morning, I was roused by my uncle's voice calling gently but persistently. I opened my eyes and saw the dim blob of his face peering from behind the jamb of the kitchen door. "What time have you?" I thought he asked me, but I was not sure. "Huh?" I mumbled sleepily. "What time have you got?" he repeated. I lifted myself on my elbow and looked at my dollar watch, which lay on the chair at the bedside. 18 past 5, I mumbled. 18 past 5? He asked. "Yes, sir." "Now is that the right time?" he asked again. I was tired, sleepy. I didn't want to look at the watch again, but I was satisfied that on the whole I'd given him the correct time. "It's right," I said, snuggling back down into my pillow. "If it's a little slow or fast, it's not far wrong." There was a short silence. I thought he had gone. "What on earth do you mean, boy?" he asked in loud anger. I sat up, blinking, staring into the shadows of the room, trying to see the expression on his face. "What do I mean?" I asked, bewildered. "I mean what I said." Had I given him the wrong time? I looked again at my watch. "It's 20 past now." "Why, you impudent black rascal," he thundered. I pushed back the covers of the bed, sensing trouble. "What are you angry about?" I asked. "I never heard a sassier black imp than you in all my life," he spluttered. I swung my feet to the floor so that I could watch him. "What are you talking about?" I asked. "You asked me the time, and I told you." "If it's a little fast or slow, it's not far wrong," he said, imitating me in an angry, sarcastic voice. "I've taught school for 30 years, and by God, I've never heard a boy say anything like that to me." "But what's wrong with what I said?" I asked, amazed. "Shut up," he shouted, "or I'll take my fist and ram it down your sassy throat. One more word out of you, and I'll get a limb and teach you a lesson." "What's the matter with you, Uncle Tom?" I asked. "What's wrong with what I said?" I could hear his breath whistling in his throat. I knew that he was furious.
This day, I'm going to give you the whipping some man ought to have given you long ago, he vowed.
I got to my feet and grabbed my clothes. The whole thing seemed unreal. I had been confronted so suddenly with struggle that I couldn't pull all the strings of the situation together at once. I didn't feel that I had given him cause to say I was sassy. I'd spoken to him just as I spoke to everybody. Others didn't resent my words, so why should he? I heard him go out of the kitchen door, and I knew that he'd gone into the backyard. I pulled on my clothes and ran to the window. I saw him tearing a long, young green switch from the elm tree. My body tightened. I was damned if he was going to beat me with it. Until a few days ago, he'd never lived near me, had never had any say in my rearing or lack of rearing. I was working, eating my meals out, buying my own clothes, giving what few pennies I could to Granny to help out in the house. And now, a strange uncle who felt that I was impolite was going to teach me to act as I had seen the backward black boys act on the plantations, was going to teach me to grin, hang my head, and mumble apologetically when I was spoken to. My senses reeled in protest. No, that could not be. He would not beat me. He was only bluffing. His anger would pass. He would think it over and realize that it wasn't worth all the bother. Dressed, I sat on the edge of the bed and waited. I heard his footsteps come onto the back porch. I felt weak all over. How long was this going to last? How long was I going to be beaten for trifles and less than trifles? I was already so conditioned toward my relatives that when I passed them, I actually had a nervous tic in my muscles. And now I was going to be beaten by someone who didn't like the tone of voice in which I spoke? I ran across the room and pulled out the dresser drawer and got my pack of razor blades. I opened it and took a thin blade of blue steel in each hand. I stood ready for him. The door opened. I was hoping desperately that this wasn't true, that this dream would end.
Richard!
He called me in a cold, even tone.
Yes, sir!
I answered, striving to keep my tension out of my voice.
Come here.
I walked into the kitchen, my eyes upon him, my hands holding the razors behind my back.
Now, Uncle Tom, what do you want with me?
I asked him.
You need a lesson in how to live with people, he said.
If I do need one, you're not going to give it to me, I said.
You'll swallow those words before I'm through with you, he vowed.
Now listen, Uncle Tom, I said. You're not going to whip me. You're a stranger to me. You don't support me. I don't live with you.
You shut that foul mouth of yours and get into the backyard, he snapped.
He hadn't seen the razors in my hand. I ducked out the kitchen door and jumped lightly off the porch to the ground. He ran down the steps and advanced with the lifted switch.
I've got a razor in each hand, I warned in a low, charged voice. If you touch me, I'll cut you. Maybe I'll get cut too, but I'll cut you, so help me God.
He paused, staring at my lifted hands in the dawning light of morning. I held a sharp blue edge of steel tightly between thumb and forefinger of each fist.
My God, he gasped. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings this morning, I told him. You insist I did. Now I'll be damned if I'm going to be beaten because of your hurt feelings. You're the worst criminal I ever saw, he exclaimed softly. If you want to fight, I'll fight. That's the way it'll be between us, I told him. You'll never amount to anything, he said, shaking his head and blinking his eyes in astonishment.
I'm not worried about that, I said. All I want you to do is keep away from me, now and always.
You'll end on the gallows, he predicted.
If I do, you'll have nothing to do with it, I said. He stared at me in silence. Evidently, he didn't believe me, for he took a step forward to test me.
"Put those razors down," he commanded. "I'll cut you! I'll cut you!"
I said, hysteria leaping into my voice, my hands slicing out with points of steel as I backed away. He stopped. He had never in his life faced a person more grimly determined. Now and then, he blinked his eyes and shook his head.
"You fool!"
he bellowed suddenly.
"I'll make you bloody if you hit me,"
I warned him. His chest heaved, and his body seemed to droop.
"Somebody will break your spirit," he said.
"It won't be you."
"You'll get yours someday.
You won't be the one to give it to me."
"And you've just been baptized," he said heavily.
"The hell with that,"
I said. We stood in the early morning light, and a touch of sun broke on the horizon. Roosters were crowing. A bird chirped nearby somewhere. Perhaps the neighbors were listening. Finally, Uncle Tom's face began to twitch. Tears rolled down his cheeks. His lips trembled.
"Boy, I'm sorry for you," he said at last.
"You'd better be sorry for yourself," I said.
"You think you're a man," he said,
dropping his arm and letting the switch drag in the dust of the yard. His lips moved as he groped for words.
"But you'll learn, and you'll learn the hard way. I wish I could be an example to you."
I knew that I had conquered him, had rid myself of him mentally and emotionally, but I wanted to be sure.
"You are not an example to me. You could never be,"
I spat at him.
"You're a warning. Your life isn't so hot that you can tell me what to do."
He repaired chairs for a living now, since he had retired from teaching.
"Do you think I want to grow up and weave the bottoms of chairs for people to sit in?"
He twitched violently, trying to control himself.
"You'll be sorry you said that," he mumbled.
He turned his tall, lean, bent body and walked slowly up the steps. I sat on the porch a long time, waiting for my emotions to ebb. Then I crept cautiously into the house, got my hat, coat, books, and went to work. Went to face the whims of the white folks. Chapter 7. Summer. Bright hot days. Hunger still a vital part of my consciousness. Passing relatives in the hallways of the crowded home and not speaking. Eating in silence at a table where prayers are said. My mother recovering slowly, but now definitely crippled for life. Will I be able to enter school in September? Loneliness. Reading, job hunting, vague hopes of going north. But what would become of my mother if I left her in this queer house? And how would I fare in a strange city? Doubt, fear. My friends are buying long pants suits that cost from $17 to $20, a sum as huge to me as the Alps. This was my reality in 1924. Word came that a nearby brickyard was hiring, and I went to investigate. I was frail, not weighing 100 pounds. At noon, I sneaked into the yard and walked among the aisles of damp, clean-smelling clay, and came to a barrow full of wet bricks just taken from the machine that shaped them. I caught hold of the handles of the barrow and was barely able to lift it. It weighed perhaps 4 times as much as I did. If I were only stronger and heavier. Later, I asked questions and found that the water boy was missing. I ran to the office and was hired. I walked in the hot sun, lugging a big zinc pail from one laboring gang of black men to another for $1 a day. A man would lift the tin dipper to his lips, take a swallow, rinse out his mouth, spit, and then drink in long, slow gulps as sweat dripped into the dipper. And off again I would go, chanting, "Water!" And somebody would yell, "Here, boy!" Deep into wet pits of clay, into sticky ditches, up slippery slopes, I would struggle with the pail. I stuck it out, reeling at times from hunger, pausing to get my breath before clambering up a hill. At the end of the week, the money sank into the endless expenses at home. Later, I got a job in the yard that paid $1.50 a day, that of Bat Boy. I went between the walls of clay and picked up bricks that had cracked open. When my barrow was full, I would wheel it out onto a wooden scaffold and dump it into a pond. I had but one fear here, a dog. He was owned by the boss of the brickyard, and he haunted the clay aisles, snapping, growling. The dog had been wounded many times, for the black workers were always hurling bricks at it. Whenever I saw the animal, I would take a brick from my load and toss it at him. He would slink away, only to appear again, showing his teeth. Several of the Negroes had been bitten and had been ill. The boss had been asked to leash the dog, but he had refused. One afternoon, I was wheeling my barrow toward the pond when something sharp sank into my thigh. I whirled. The dog crouched a few feet away, snarling. I'd been bitten. I drove the dog away and opened my trousers. Teeth marks showed deep and red. I didn't mind the stinging hurt, but I was afraid of infection. When I went to the office to report that the boss's dog had bitten me, I was met by a tall, blonde, white girl. "What do you want?" she asked. "I want to see the boss, ma'am." "For what?" "His dog bit me, ma'am, and I'm afraid I might get an infection." "Where did he bite you?" "On my leg," I lied, shying from telling her where the bite was. "Let's see," she said. "No, ma'am. Can I see the boss?" "He isn't here now," she said, and went back to her typing. I returned to work, stopping occasionally to examine the teeth marks. They were swelling. Later in the afternoon, a tall white man wearing a cool white suit, a Panama hat, and white shoes came toward me. "Is this the nigger?" he asked a black boy as he pointed at me. "Yes, sir," the black boy answered. "Come here, nigger," he called me. I went to him. "They tell me my dog bit you," he said. "Yes, sir." I pulled down my trousers and he looked. "Hmm," he grunted, then laughed. "A dog bite can't hurt a nigger." "It's swelling and it hurts," I said. "If it bothers you, let me know," he said. "But I never saw a dog yet that could really hurt a nigger." He turned and walked away, and the black boys gathered to watch his tall form disappear down the aisles of wet bricks. "Son of a bitch. He'll get here someday. Boy, their hearts are hard. Lord, white man'll do anything." "Break up that prayer meeting," the white straw boss yelled. The wheelbarrows rolled again. A boy came close to me. "You better see a doctor," he whispered. "I ain't got no money," I said. 2 days passed, and luckily, the redness and swelling went away. Summer wore on, and the brickyard closed. Again, I was out of work. I heard that caddies were wanted, and I tramped 5 miles to the golf links. I was hired by a florid-faced white man at the rate of 50 cents for 9 holes. I didn't know the game, and I lost 3 balls in as many minutes. It seemed that my eyes couldn't trace the flight of the balls. The man dismissed me. I watched the other boys do their jobs, and within half an hour, I had another golf bag and was following a ball. I made a dollar. I returned home disgusted, tired, hungry, hating the sight of a golf course. School opened, and though I hadn't prepared myself, I enrolled. The school was far across town, and the walking distance alone consumed my breakfast of mush and lard gravy. I attended classes without books for a month, then got a job working mornings and evenings for $3 a week. I grew silent and reserved as the nature of the world in which I lived became plain and undeniable. The bleakness of the future affected my will to study. Granny had already thrown out hints that it was time for me to be on my own. But what had I learned so far that would help me to make a living? Nothing. I could be a porter like my father before me, but what else? And the problem of living as a Negro was cold and hard. What was it that made the hate of whites for blacks so steady, seemingly so woven into the texture of things? What kind of life was possible under that hate? How had this hate come to be? Nothing about the problems of Negroes was ever taught in the classrooms at school. And whenever I would raise these questions with the boys, they would either remain silent or turn the subject into a joke. They were vocal about the petty individual wrongs they suffered, but they possessed no desire for a knowledge of the picture as a whole. Then why was I worried about it? Was I really as bad as my uncles and aunts and granny repeatedly said? Why was it considered wrong to ask questions? Was I right when I resisted punishment? It was inconceivable to me that one should surrender to what seemed wrong, and most of the people I had met seemed wrong. Ought one to surrender to authority even when one believed that that authority was wrong? And if the answer was yes, then I knew that I would always be wrong, because I could never do it. Then how could one live in a world in which one's mind and perceptions meant nothing, and authority and tradition meant everything? There were no answers. The eighth grade days flowed in their hungry path, and I grew more conscious of myself. I sat in classes, bored, wondering, dreaming. One long, dry afternoon, I took out my composition book and told myself that I would write a story. It was sheer idleness that led me to it. What would the story be about? It resolved itself into a plot about a villain who wanted a widow's home, and I called it The Voodoo of Hell's Half Acre. It was crudely atmospheric, emotional, intuitively psychological, and stemmed from pure feeling. I finished it in 3 days, and then wondered what to do with it. The local Negro newspaper, that's it. I sailed into the office and shoved my ragged composition book under the nose of the man who called himself the editor.
"What is that?" he asked.
"A story," I said.
"A news story?"
"No, fiction."
"All right, I'll read it," he said.
He pushed my composition book back on his desk and looked at me curiously, sucking at his pipe.
"But I want you to read it now," I said.
He blinked. I had no idea how newspapers were run. I thought that one took a story to an editor and he sat down then and there and read it and said yes or no.
"I'll read this and let you know about it tomorrow," he said.
I was disappointed. I had taken time to write it, and he seemed distant and uninterested.
"Give me the story," I said, reaching for it.
He turned from me, took up the book, and read 10 pages or more.
"Won't you come in tomorrow?" he asked. "I'll have it finished then."
I honestly relented.
"All right," I said. "I'll stop in tomorrow."
I left with the conviction that he wouldn't read it. Now where else could I take it after he had turned it down? The next afternoon, en route to my job, I stepped into the newspaper office.
"Where's my story?" I asked. It's in galleys, he said. What's that? I asked. I didn't know what galleys were. It's set up in type, he said. We're publishing it. How much money will I get? I asked, excited. We can't pay for manuscript, he said. But you sell your papers for money, I said with logic. Yes, but we're young in business, he explained. But you're asking me to give you my story, but you don't give your papers away, I said. He laughed. Look, we're just starting. This story will put your name before our readers. Now that's something, he said. But if the story is good enough to sell to your readers, then you ought to give me some of the money you get from it, I insisted. He laughed again, and I sensed that I was amusing him. I'm going to offer you something more valuable than money, he said. I'll give you a chance to learn to write. I was pleased, but I still thought he was taking advantage of me. When will you publish my story? I'm dividing it into 3 installments, he said. The first installment appears this week, but the main thing is, will you get news for me on a space rate basis? I work mornings and evenings for $3 a week, I said. Oh, he said, then you better keep that. But what are you doing this summer? Nothing. Then come to see me before you take another job, he said, and write some more stories. A few days later, my classmates came to me with baffled eyes, holding copies of the Southern Register in their hands. Did you really write that story? They asked me. Yes. Why? Because I wanted to. Where did you get it from? I made it up. You didn't. You copied it out of a book. If I had, no one would publish it. But what are they publishing it for? So people can read it. Who told you to do that? Nobody. Then why did you do it? Because I wanted to, I said again. They were convinced that I had not told them the truth. We'd never had any instruction in literary matters at school. The literature of the nation or the Negro had never been mentioned. My schoolmates couldn't understand why anyone would want to write a story. And above all, they couldn't understand why I'd called it the voodoo of Hell's Half Acre. The mood out of which a story was written was the most alien thing conceivable to them. They looked at me with new eyes, and a distance, a suspiciousness came between us. If I'd thought anything in writing the story, I thought that perhaps it would make me more acceptable to them, and now it was cutting me off from them more completely than ever. At home, the effects were no less disturbing. Granny came into my room early one morning and sat on the edge of my bed.
Richard, what is this you're putting in the papers? She asked.
A story, I said.
About what?
It's just a story, Granny.
But they tell me it's been in 3 times.
It's the same story. It's in 3 parts.
But what's it about?
She insisted. I hedged, fearful of getting into a religious argument. It's just a story I made up, I said.
Then it's a lie, she said. Oh, Christ, I said. You must get out of this house if you take the name of the Lord in vain, she said.
Granny, please, I'm sorry, I pleaded. But it's hard to tell you about the story. You see, Granny, everybody knows that the story isn't true, but...
Then why write it? She asked.
Because people might want to read it.
That's the devil's work, she said, and left.
My mother also was worried.
Son, you ought to be more serious, she said. You're growing up now, and you won't be able to get jobs if you let people think you're weak-minded. Suppose the superintendent of schools would ask you to teach here in Jackson, and he found out that you had been writing stories. I couldn't answer her. I'll be all right, Mama, I said. Uncle Tom, though surprised, was highly critical and contemptuous. The story had no point, he said. And whoever heard of a story by the title of The Voodoo of Hell's Half Acre? Aunt Addie said that it was a sin for anyone to use the word hell, and that what was wrong with me was that I had nobody to guide me. She blamed the whole thing upon my upbringing. In the end, I was so angry that I refused to talk about the story. From no quarter, with the exception of the Negro newspaper editor, had there come a single encouraging word. It was rumored that the principal wanted to know why I had used the word hell. I felt that I had committed a crime. Had I been conscious of the full extent to which I was pushing against the current of my environment, I would have been frightened altogether out of my attempts at writing. But my reactions were limited to the attitude of the people about me, and I didn't speculate or generalize. I dreamed of going north and writing books, novels. The North symbolized to me all that I hadn't felt and seen. It had no relation whatever to what actually existed. Yet by imagining a place where everything was possible, I kept hope alive in me. But where had I got this notion of doing something in the future, of going away from home and accomplishing something that would be recognized by others? I had, of course, read my Horatio Alger stories, my pulp stories, and I knew my get-rich-quick Wallingford series from cover to cover, though I had sense enough not to hope to get rich. Even to my naive imagination, that possibility was too remote. I knew that I lived in a country in which the aspirations of black people were limited, marked off. Yet I felt that I had to go somewhere and do something to redeem my being alive. I was building up in me a dream which the entire educational system of the South had been rigged to stifle. I was feeling the very thing that the state of Mississippi had spent millions of dollars to make sure that I would never feel. I was becoming aware of the thing that the Jim Crow laws had been drafted and passed to keep out of my consciousness. I was acting on impulses that Southern senators in the nation's capital had striven to keep out of Negro life. I was beginning to dream the dreams that the state had said were wrong, that the schools had said were taboo. Had I been articulate about my ultimate aspirations, no doubt someone would have told me what I was bargaining for, but nobody seemed to know, and least of all, did I? My classmates felt that I was doing something that was vaguely wrong, but they didn't know how to express it. As the outside world grew more meaningful, I became more concerned, tense, and my classmates and my teachers would say, "Why do you ask so many questions?" or "Keep quiet." I was in my 15th year. In terms of schooling, I was far behind the average youth of the nation, but I didn't know that. In me was shaping a yearning for a kind of consciousness, a mode of being that the way of life about me had said could not be, must not be, and upon which the penalty of death had been placed. Somewhere, in the dead of the southern night, my life had switched onto the wrong track, and without my knowing it, the locomotive of my heart was rushing down a dangerously steep slope, heading for a collision, heedless of the warning red lights that blinked all about me, the sirens and the bells and the screams that filled the air. Chapter 8. Summer again. The old problem of hunting for a job. I told the woman for whom I was working, a Mrs. Bibbs,
that I needed an all-day job that would pay me enough money to buy clothes and books for the next school term. She took the matter up with her husband, who was a foreman in a sawmill.
"So you want to work in the mill, huh?"
he asked.
"Yes, sir."
He came to me and put his hands under my arms and lifted me from the floor as though I were a bundle of feathers.
"You're too light for our work," he said.
"But maybe I could do something there," I said.
"That's the problem," he said soberly. "The work's heavy and dangerous."
He was silent, and I knew that he considered the matter closed. That was the way things were between whites and blacks in the South. Many of the most important things were never openly said. They were understated and left to seep through to one. I, in turn, said nothing. But I didn't leave the room. My standing silent was a way of asking him to reconsider, telling him that I wanted ever so much to try for a job in his mill.
"All right," he said finally. "Come to the mill in the morning. I'll see what I can do. But I don't think that you'll like it."
I was at the mill at dawn the next morning and saw men lifting huge logs with tackle blocks. There were scores of buzzing steel saws biting into green wood with loud whines.
"Watch out!"
somebody yelled. I looked around and saw a black man pointing above my head. I glanced up. A log was swinging toward me. I scrambled out of its path. The black man came to my side.
"What do you want here, boy?"
"Mr. Bibbs, the foreman, told me to look around. I'm looking for a job," I said.
The man gazed at me intently.
"I wouldn't try for this if I was you," he said.
"If you know this game, all right. But this is dangerous stuff for a guy that's green."
He held up his right hand, from which three fingers were missing.
"See?"
I nodded and left. Empty days, long days, bright, hot days. The sun heated the pavements until they felt like the top of an oven. I spent the mornings hunting for jobs, and I read during the afternoons. One morning, I was walking toward the center of town and passed the home of a classmate, Ned Greenley. He was sitting on his porch, looking glum.
"Hello, Ned. What's new?" I asked.
"You heard, haven't you?" he asked.
"About what?"
"My brother Bob."
"No, what happened?"
Ned began to weep, softly.
"They killed him,"
he managed to say.
"The white folks?"
I asked in a whisper, guessing. He sobbed his answer. Bob was dead. I had met him only a few times, but I felt that I had known him through his brother.
"What happened?"
"That they took him in a car out on a country road. They shot him,"
Ned whimpered. I had heard that Bob was working at one of the hotels in town.
"Why?"
"That they said he was fooling with a white prostitute there in the hotel," Ned said.
Inside of me, my world crashed, and my body felt heavy. I stood looking down the quiet, sun-filled street. Bob had been caught by the White Death, the threat of which hung over every male black in the South. I had heard whispered tales of black boys having sex relations with white prostitutes in the hotels in town, but I had never paid any close attention to them. Now those tales came home to me in the form of the death of a man I knew. I did not search for a job that day. I returned home and sat on my porch, too, and stared. What I had heard altered the look of the world, induced in me a temporary paralysis of will and impulse. The penalty of death awaited me if I made a false move, and I wondered if it was worthwhile to make any move at all. The things that influenced my conduct as a Negro didn't have to happen to me directly. I needed but to hear of them, to feel their full effects in the deepest layers of my consciousness. Indeed, the white brutality that I had not seen was more effective control of my behavior than that which I knew. The actual experience would have let me see the realistic outlines of what was really happening. But as long as it remained something terrible and yet remote, something whose horror and blood might descend upon me at any moment, I was compelled to give my entire imagination over to it, an act which blocked the springs of thought and feeling in me, creating a sense of distance between me and the world in which I lived. A few days later, I sought out the editor of the local Negro newspaper and found that he couldn't hire me. I had doubts now about my being able to enter school that fall. The empty days of summer rolled on. Whenever I met my classmates, they would tell me about the jobs they had found, how some of them had left town to work in summer resorts in the north. "Why did they not tell me of these jobs?" I demanded of them. They said that they simply hadn't thought of it, and as I heard the words fall from their lips, my sense of isolation became doubly acute. But after all, what would make them think of me in connection with jobs, when for years I had encountered them only casually in the classroom? I'd had no association with them. The religious home in which I lived, my mush and lard gravy poverty, had cut me off from the normal processes of the lives of black boys my own age. One afternoon, I made a discovery in the home that stunned me. I was talking to my cousin Maggie, who was a few months younger than I, when Uncle Tom entered the room. He paused, stared at me with silent hostility, then called his daughter. I gave the matter no thought. A few moments later, I rose from my chair where I had been reading, and was on my way down the hall when I heard Uncle Tom scolding his daughter. I caught a few phrases.
"You want me to break your neck? Didn't I tell you to stay away from him? That boy is a dangerous fool, I tell you. Then why don't you keep away from him and make the other children keep away from him? Ask me no questions, but do as I tell you. Keep away from him, or I'll skin you."
And I could hear my cousin's whimpering replies. My throat grew tight with anger. I wanted to rush into the room and demand an explanation, but I held still. How long had this been going on? I thought back over the time since Uncle Tom and his family had moved into the house, and I was filled with dismay as I recalled that on scarcely any occasion had any of his children ever been alone with me. "Be careful now," I told myself. "Don't see what isn't there." But no matter how carefully I weighed my memories, I could recall no innocent intimacy, no games, no playing, none of the association that usually exists between young people living in the same house. Then suddenly, I was reliving that early morning when I had held Uncle Tom at bay with my razors. Though I must have seemed brutal and desperate to him, I had never thought of myself as being so. And now I was appalled at how I was regarded. It was a flash of insight which revealed to me the true nature of my relations with my family, an insight which altered the entire course of my life. I was now definitely decided upon leaving home, but I would remain until the 9th grade term had ended. There were many days when I spoke to no one in the home except my mother. My life was falling to pieces, and I was acutely aware of it. I was poised for flight, but I was waiting for some event, some word, some act, some circumstance to furnish the impetus. I returned to my job at Mrs. Bibbs and bought my school books. My clothing remained little better than rags. Luckily, the studies in the 9th, my last year at school, were light. And during a part of the term, The teacher turned over the class to my supervision, an honor that helped me emotionally and made me hope faintly. It was even hinted that, if I kept my grades high, it would be possible for me to teach in the city school system. During that winter, my brother came home from Chicago. I was glad to see him, though we were strangers. But it wasn't long before I felt that the affection shown him by the family was far greater than that which I had ever had from them. Slowly, my brother grew openly critical of me, taking his cue from those about him, and it hurt. My loneliness became organic. I felt walled in, and I grew irritable. I associated less and less with my classmates, for their talk was now full of the schools they planned to attend when the term was over. The cold days dragged mechanically. Up early and to my job, splitting wood, carrying coal, sweeping floors, then off to school and boredom. The school term ended. I was selected as valedictorian of my class and assigned to write a paper to be delivered at one of the public auditoriums. One morning, the principal summoned me to his office.
"Well, Richard Wright, here's your speech," he said with smooth bluntness and shoved a stack of stapled sheets across his desk.
"What speech?" I asked as I picked up the papers.
"The speech you're to say the night of graduation," he said.
"But, Professor, I've written my speech already," I said. He laughed confidently, indulgently.
"Listen, boy, you're going to speak to both white and colored people that night. What can you alone think of saying to them? You have no experience."
I burned. "I know that I'm not educated, Professor," I said. "But the people are coming to hear the students, and I won't make a speech that you've written." He leaned back in his chair and looked at me in surprise.
"You know, we've never had a boy like you in this school before," he said. "You've had your way around here. Just how you managed to do it, I don't know. But listen, take this speech and say it. I know what's best for you. You can't afford to just say anything before those white people that night."
He paused and added meaningfully,
"The superintendent of schools will be there. You're in a position to make a good impression on him. I've been a principal for more years than you are old, boy. I've seen many a boy and girl graduate from this school, and none of them was too proud to recite a speech I wrote for them."
I had to make up my mind quickly. I was faced with a matter of principle. I wanted to graduate, but I didn't want to make a public speech that was not my own. "Professor, I'm going to say my own speech that night," I said. He grew angry.
"You're just a young, hot-headed fool," he said.
He toyed with a pencil and looked at me.
"Suppose you don't graduate."
"But I passed my examinations," I said.
"Look, mister," he shot at me, "I'm the man who says who passes at this school."
I was so astonished that my body jerked. I had gone to this school for 2 years, and I had never suspected what kind of man the principal was. It simply had never occurred to me to wonder about him. "Then I don't graduate," I said flatly. I turned to leave.
"Say, you come here," he called.
I turned and faced him. He was smiling at me in a remote, superior sort of way.
"You know, I'm glad I talked to you," he said. "I was seriously thinking of placing you in the school system, teaching. But now, I don't think that you'll fit."
He was tempting me, baiting me. This was the technique that snared black young minds into supporting the Southern way of life. "Look, Professor, I may never get a chance to go to school again," I said. but I like to do things right.
What do you mean?
I've no money. I'm going to work. Now, this ninth grade diploma isn't going to help me much in life. I'm not bitter about it. It's not your fault. But I'm just not going to do things this way.
Have you talked to anybody about this? He asked me.
No. Why?
Are you sure?
This is the first I've heard of it, Professor, I said, amazed again.
You haven't talked to any white people about this?
No, sir.
I just wanted to know, he said.
My amazement increased. The man was afraid now for his job. Professor, you don't understand me, I smiled.
You're just a young, hot fool, he said, confident again. Wake up, boy. Learn the world you're living in. You're smart, and I know what you're after. I've kept closer track of you than you think. I know your relatives. Now, if you play safe,
he smiled and winked,
I'll help you go to school, to college.
I want to learn, Professor, I told him. But there are some things I don't want to know.
Goodbye, he said.
I went home, hurt but determined. I'd been talking to a bought man, and he had tried to buy me. I felt that I'd been dealing with something unclean. That night, Griggs, a boy who had gone through many classes with me, came to the house.
Look, Dick, you're throwing away your future here in Jackson, he said.
Go to the principal. Talk to him. Take his speech and say it. I'm saying the one he wrote, so why can't you?
What the hell? What can you lose?
No, I said.
Why?
I know only a hell of a little, but my speech is going to reflect that, I said.
Then you're going to be blacklisted for teaching jobs, he said.
Who the hell said I was going to teach? I asked.
God, but you've got a will, he said.
It's not will. I just don't want to do things that way, I said. He left. 2 days later, Uncle Tom came to me. I knew that the principal had called him in.
I hear that the principal wants you to say a speech which you've rejected, he said.
Yes, sir, that's right, I said.
May I read the speech you've written? He asked.
Certainly, I said, giving him the manuscript.
And may I see the one the principal wrote?
I gave him the principal's speech, too. He went to his room and read them. I sat quiet, waiting. He returned.
The principal's speech is the better speech, he said.
I don't doubt it, I replied. But why did they ask me to write his speech if I can't deliver it?
Would you let me work on your speech? He asked.
No, sir.
Now look, Richard, this is your future.
Uncle Tom, I don't care to discuss this with you, I said. He stared at me, then left. The principal's speech was simpler and clearer than mine, but it didn't say anything. Mine was cloudy, but it said what I wanted to say. What could I do? I had half a mind not to show up at the graduation exercises. I was hating my environment more each day. As soon as school was over, I would get a job, save money, and leave. Griggs, who had accepted a speech written by the principal, came to my house each day, and we went off into the woods to practice orating. Day in and day out, we spoke to the trees, to the creeks, frightening the birds, making the cows in the pastures stare at us in fear. I memorized my speech so thoroughly that I could have recited it in my sleep. The news of my clash with the principal had spread through the class, and the students became openly critical of me.
Richard, you're a fool. You're throwing away every chance you've got. If they had known the kind of fool boy you are, they would never have made you valedictorian, they said.
I gritted my teeth and kept my mouth shut, but my rage was mounting by the hour. My classmates, motivated by a desire to save me, pestered me until I all but reached the breaking point. In the end, the principal had to caution them to let me alone, for fear I would throw up the sponge and walk out. I had one more problem to settle before I could make my speech. I was the only boy in my class wearing short pants, and I was grimly determined to leave school in long pants. Was I not going to work? Would I not be on my own? When my desire for long pants became known at home, yet another storm shook the house.
"You're trying to go too fast," my mother said.
"You're nothing but a child," Uncle Tom pronounced.
"He's beside himself," Granny said.
I served notice that I was making my own decisions from then on. I borrowed money from Mrs. Bibbs, my employer, made a down payment on a pearl gray suit. If I couldn't pay for it, I would take the damn thing back after graduation. On the night of graduation, I was nervous and tense. I rose and faced the audience, and my speech rolled out. When my voice stopped, there was some applause. I didn't care if they liked it or not. I was through. Immediately, even before I left the platform, I tried to shunt all memory of the event from me. A few of my classmates managed to shake my hand as I pushed toward the door, seeking the street. Somebody invited me to a party, and I did not accept. I did not want to see any of them again. I walked home, saying to myself, "The hell with it." With almost 17 years of baffled living behind me, I faced the world in 1925.
This ends Disc 7.